Hey there, everybody. Joseph Amato's back here with What's Next, the West Wing Podcast. Anthony, you're looking a little peaked.
I'm looking a little what?
Peaked.
What's peaking?
Not peaked. Peaking like duck. What's wrong? You okay? You're looking a little scared there.
Scared?
Yeah, you like what you said, you know, you give like the high side to be like, go, and then, you know, you went like, I can't, you're not, people aren't going to see my face, so I can't. Suffice it to say, there was a look of sheer terror. It wasn't that bad, but it was...
Well, it's multiple layers of terror. The first one is that this isn't going to work. The second thing is, like, we have this new setting, and I don't know where the thing is when I press record.
What's the thing? You always say thing, and I don't know.
I don't know what it's called.
Cursor, maybe?
Is it called cursor?
I don't know.
I'd rather just call it thing if I don't know what it's called.
Right, but then I don't know what you're talking about. More importantly, well, not more importantly, neither do the people that are listening to us. And by people, I mean person. All right,
we're getting better. We have like three now.
Yeah. Guys, what's going on? What's Next, the West Wing Podcast is back. We have part two of
parte dos.
It's part two of In Excelsis Deo, where we tackle everything from gift giving to Toby Ziegler and his journey. Sam, Laurie, Josh, Leo, that whole...
Oh, that was sexy.
Yeah. No, I don't know what that was. I don't know if that was sexy.
That was an aggressive shimmy.
That was like, I shimmied, right. Again,
an aggressive
stop.
Shimmy.
They didn't see my shimmy. I should shimmy for you people.
Hmm.
But little, small, tiny thing. Don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but last episode and in previous episodes, we have been giving a lot of devoting a lot of time to the idea that... engagement, confrontation, being inclusive is preferential, even if not always better than isolation. We understand that sometimes, I mean, we've talked about the fact that I think we understand that sometimes, you know, no matter how much you engage with someone, you just can't change their mind. But we were talking about, you know, hate crime legislation and how... difficult that area must be. I mean, if someone is a hardcore racist, you know, it's got to be hard to change their minds. Anyway, we were talking about how we still think that engagement is preferential to isolation. And with no facts to back it up, you know, we're like the anti-radio lab. We're just talking about with our own opinions and based on experience, which science loves, experiential data, anecdotal. But in any case... we actually, in the past, we came across Daryl Davis is his name, right?
Daryl Davis.
He is a black musician who legit, like, befriended KKK members, and while not converting all of them, converted enough from being KKK members to not, to where, I forget what state it was, the chapter of their KKK dissolved. And it was all through engagement. Now, we don't have enough time to go through all this. But I highly recommend that if this interests you, that if you disagreed with us in terms of engagement, maybe check this out. Maybe that'll change your minds. Maybe you'll just say, oh, well, that's a unique example that doesn't, you know, give a fuller story. But it's important, you know. I don't know.
You got to think how ignorant they are to begin with. Like,
it's all based in ignorance.
I know, but, like, they didn't see his eyes through the little... hooding?
What are you talking about?
Like they didn't know he was black.
No, he didn't go undercover.
Oh.
No. See, this is why.
I got the story wrong.
See, this is why. We're not, I don't want to get into this now because we got too much to talk about.
All right.
If you're interested, as clearly you are, Anthony, suggest you Google that guy.
Yeah. And I knew he was a jazz musician, but that was about it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he didn't. This isn't like a spy story where he goes in and he's like always wearing gloves so his hands aren't seen.
He infiltrated
or something. Yeah. No, that's not how that works. Okay. Moving on.
Pivot.
Moving on up. Wait, I don't think we can sing. We're not allowed to sing. We got to stop singing. Right?
Just ruined all the fun.
It's not me. It's like laws. You want to pay money? You can be the one that pays money.
You could be the one that pays money.
No, you're the one that wants to... Fuck you. All right, so...
You wish. That's like the best comeback to that.
Yeah, well, whenever we're at work and someone's like behind you, I'm always like, you wish.
Yeah.
That's my comment every single time. Behind you, yeah, you wish. Miguel's gotten to the point where he's like, yup. You guys don't know Miguel, but Miguel is hysterical. Okay, so moving on. I think we're gonna start with your little story
line there.
Your boy Samuel Norman Seaborn. Samuel Norman Seaborn. So it's a very interesting little story arc, and I have a couple of questions to ask you how you feel about these things. The first thing that happens is, excuse me, you basically have Josh go to Leo and say, listen, Sam's got this friend. And Leo's like, yeah, no, I know. And he's like, I want to maybe have that, you know, in my pocket. And Leo's like, no, I don't want it in your pocket. I don't want it in the president's pocket. You know, okay, fine. And then you have this nice little convenient thing where all of a sudden Donna knows something's going on with Leo. It's a sin of convenience in writing, and I'll give Sorkin a pass on this because so much is happening. I mean, we're doing two podcasts on one episode, that I'll give him a break. But it is a sin of convenience just to move the plot forward to all of a sudden have Donna know what's going on with Leo when no one knew prior. But whatever, that's fine. But she says to him, you know, what's going on with Leo? And he's like, what are you talking about or whatever? Everybody's talking about it. You shouldn't be talking about it, you know. But it gets to the point where Josh says he's not going to do anything. And Donna, you know, basically says if anyone else were in trouble, he would be the first one to help. And then Josh says that interesting line of, what, are you looking at me with your face there? You know, like, I just killed your hamster. And she says, and you have to take the writer's word for it, it was just my regular face. So you have to believe her. So what do you make of that?
I definitely projection. Well, you never know. You never know. Like, it could be, if you're saying that we have to take the writer's word for it, which...
Yeah, it's pointed. It's at that place where it's clearly, it's done in a way where there's no subtext. She literally does mean that. So, yeah.
It's interesting, though, because this happens all the time. And, like, I always want to say when somebody gives me a face that I think I'm perceiving a face, you know, you have to reflect on yourself and say, am I just projecting my own feelings about the situation onto the other person, which is making me see something that's not really there. But I always wonder if there is something there, and there's no way to really tell, especially if the person's saying there's nothing there.
Yeah. There's really no way to tell. Cause then you don't know if they're lying. I mean, okay. So we can agree that Josh is projecting his own guilt onto Donna.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Because I think that's absolutely true. I feel like I do it all the time, and I'm super hyper sensitive and aware of it. You know, I was just talking with, you know, a friend of ours, Kim, you know, yesterday or 2 days ago, and just talking about how, like, the more introspective and the more self-reflective I've gotten, the more I'm critical of myself to the point of almost paralysis, because almost everything now I think to myself, wait, did I just create that scenario? Was that me? You know, I feel a certain way and I feel like someone else is at fault. Chances are it's not completely the other person's fault, but how much responsibility do I bear? And now I'm just like, okay, well, now I can't take any action because now I've gone down the rabbit hole and I can't do anything. And just like you're talking about, it's a very similar circumstance for me. I it's hard.
I totally get that. It gives merit to the quote, ignorance is bliss, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
You know, it's even in the case, like, I feel like the more education people receive, the more calculated they are with responses. They're more or less willing to put themselves out there with an opinion because there's more that goes behind it. Like, you're less...
Yeah, that's, you know, like the Einstein quote. Now we're getting in a quote off.
Mm-hmm.
What he said, it's something like, idiots always speak, but smart people don't. That was an awful... You talk, because I'm going to find this quote.
No, I totally think that's it. And I think that the more people learn about it. The more introspective they are, the more, you know, self-aware they are. You do have to take responsibility for a lot of things that come into your life. You know, you are the sum total of all of your choices. You know, so if I'm choosing to put myself in this situation and create the situation, how much of that situation was my fault versus it being a mutual creation?
Well, and then we get, we also then get into that area where it's going to be difficult because I think introspection the area that we're talking about, at a certain point, you do have to take action, okay? You have to make a decision. You have to be like, okay, no, this person was at fault or I was at fault or this or that. But the place that I find myself in a lot of the times is that indecision because I'm not really sure, mm-hmm. blah, 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 blah.
Sometimes you have to make a decision.
Right, and that's the point. And that's what I think I'm trying to get to is that, you know, as good as it is to be introspective and all that stuff, there is a price to pay for that, and it can come at this paralysis that I'm talking about. Like, sometimes I just don't know. Like, so, you know, like we have an issue going on at work with this person or that person, and it's like, okay, well, someone's at fault, and I don't know who it is, and I guess I got to make a decision so that we can move forward. You know what I mean?
But this is why I stress the importance of surrounding yourself with people who are different than you. Because, you know, they have your blind spots. What you're not good at making a decision, they might be good at making decisions and can
right.
consult you.
Yeah, but I think more importantly is not just different than you, but people that are smart or smarter than you. Because there are a lot of people with a lot of different opinions.
I don't know if you can say objectively that one person is smarter than another person outside the use of a cognitive ability test or an IQ test.
Well, I don't mean, you know, getting a higher mark in a spelling bee. I just mean someone that I would consider you someone who is a good person, right? But there are several people that I would not consider their opinions necessarily as highly as yours because of their inability to perceive. Like, they might not even be able to have this conversation that you and I are having.
Maybe. But so I think this goes back to something we were talking about in a really early episode when the president was with the Joint Chiefs.
Yeah.
And you were like, you know, well, the president should be able to make these decisions. He should have an opinion. We were like, but he's so paralyzed. And I said, no, this is why he appoints his staff, you know, because they cover the areas that he's not well versed in.
Right, but he doesn't hire just any military person. He looks for someone specifically that has a certain pedigree in certain areas. So in that regard, he actually is trying to grade out who is better or worse. And that's my point, is that okay. You just can't surround yourselves with people that are just different than you. Difference is good, but there has to be some level of, okay, this person is, capable of abstract thought and capable of, you know, whatever it is your, you know, criteria right. are. But
I guess it depends on what you're trying to get out of the situation.
That's
too.
Also true. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because we talk about Miguel too. He's a great guy. I wouldn't want to spend every day with him, but I would like him around. He's a good opinion to have on certain things.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? I mean, and he's young. He's interesting. I mean, I think it's good. I like being surrounded by different people because they always give me, you know, that's why Hoboken is a tough town. It's just all, dude.
It's
white
homogenous.
People being white people. Oh,
it's rough.
It's killing me. All right. So I think we feel all right. So we're on point with that. With what's going on with Josh. Well, we had a nice little interlude there with what we felt. Okay. So after this is when Josh goes to Sam and is like, Sam, we got to go help Leo. Actually, he says, do you have, you know, your friend? Can we go see her? Sam wants no part of this. And then Josh explains why, and then he's all in. Now, again, I'm sorry. I keep deferring to you, and maybe when it gets to Toby, I'll take the reins a little bit more. But your opinion on this scene?
Yeah, like, why you got to put me in that situation?
What? Well, because I know that you like him, so I want you to talk about
him. No, I'm talking about if I was Sam And
yeah, no, I know what you were doing. I just wanted to make you say it.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, no problem. I know you think of yourself as Sam. You're like, why do people have to put me in that situation? My name is Sam.
Why you got to do that to me?
I know. Yeah.
No, I totally get where he's coming from. Like, at first, like, if someone came to me in a work setting, in a professional setting, and asked me to use my personal connections for the greater benefit of something that was going on inside of work, I mean...
Because, well, he doesn't even... You don't even know that at first. All he's like is, I just want to see her.
Well, yeah, I'm going to...
And then he's like, absolutely not. And then he explains why, and he's like, turns on a dime.
Yeah, I still think that he's hesitant, but he knows that's the best way forward. So he's going to acquiesce,
in
obviously.
What way do you feel like he's hesitant?
Because he knows that he knows that he's going to get a lot of shit from Lori by doing this.
Okay.
And Lori is somebody who he's come to like, he's become very fond of.
Right.
And to put her in this situation, he knows that he's going out on a limb. And he knows that that's not the right way to really do by her, but for the greater good of the situation, he knows that that's what needs to be done.
All right. So then let's move on to the scene where the confrontation is, because now you're getting into that. I completely agree with you. I mean, I think the circumstance completely alters. I don't know if it alters Sam's opinion, but it certainly alters Sam's priorities and the way he's going to deal with the situation. Because yes, at first he's just like, absolutely no, Josh. Leo's in trouble this badly. We're going to go. You know, it's not, you know, it's just the circumstance dictates behavior, which is always, I mean, this is my thing on free will. We're going to have to do like a whole episode.
Oh, God.
Listen, circumstance dictates behavior. You have no, it's absolutely true. It's just, if the circumstance were even different from this, it would dictate a different behavior from Sam, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
There's actually this is like a really big thing. Philip Zimbardo's book on the Lucifer effect. It talks about how the context of a situation always inevitably will outpower a person's individual personality. So the situation dictates behavior, essentially.
Yeah.
No matter who the person is or how they normally would behave, they did psychological...
Not to mention how they were raised.
Right.
And the literal wirings in their head.
Yep.
I mean, when you really do start to think about it, ladies and gentlemen out there, who's really driving the car? It's not you. It's not me. It's it's my mechanics, it's the situation, and it's how I was raised.
And I think that's a sexy way to think about it, to say that, you know, the whole free will discussion. But I don't know if I'm so quick to buy into that, so as much as just to say at a high level that situations typically dictate behavior.
No, but you
behavior.
Do buy into it. You know that free will doesn't exist.
I do, but I
all
mean,
right. We're not getting sidetracked on free will.
All right,
we're not going to do that.
All
okay,
right.
So all right,
you started.
I did. That's my own fault, but that's because it's my favorite thing. Because no one wants to. Everyone wants to think that they're important and that their brain, that they are in control of their own things, and you're just an animal with the thing. Okay, so let's move on to that scene, because it's. I love the open of that scene. Knock on the door, and it's a tight close up. Through the door, through the glass, and you can see Lori. She's in a robe, I think you see her, and she's like drying
her hair.
She's
got out of the shower.
Yeah.
She's happy.
So, well, you don't know that yet. The door opens and she's smiling.
True.
And in the background, facing camera, is Lori. In the foreground, looking away from camera, is Sam. And her smile falls. And you don't know why, as far as the picture is concerned, like what you're seeing on screen, until they give the reverse angle. And it's just a nice little reveal. I mean, you knew that Josh was going to be there. I almost wish they had cut that out so that we didn't know Josh was going to be there, because then it's just a great... I mean, this is what directing is. I made Anthony watch this scene with the sound off, because if it's good directing, you should be able to tell what's going on more or less without dialogue. You should be able... Because film and television is it's a visual medium. The story is told in pictures. So smile falls, reverse
like,
angle.
Doing?
Yeah, I know.
Put on the sound.
You need the sound.
I want to watch this.
And then Josh is in the background looking all Creep City. So
he was creepy back there.
He was. But at this point, we learn a very important thing, I think, moving forward in this scene, which is Lori is being ambushed.
Mm-hmm.
Because she says, I think, pretty quickly after that, I think her first line actually is something to the effect of, like I said, I only have a few minutes, or I don't have a lot of time, something to that effect. And then Sam's like, we'll get right to the point. Lori says, please, as she's shooting fucking daggers at Sam. Mm-hmm. I mean, she is looking at him with such hate in her eyes in this moment. So you understand now that everything Lori says from this point on does not have the benefit of clear thought. This isn't a reasoned argument on her side. She hasn't had a lot of time to digest this. So while I think some of the things that she brings up are kind of bullshit, I cut her all the slack in the world because of the position that she's been put in by Sam. And I have to wonder whether or not that was the best way to do this. Like, if I'm Sam, I don't know that showing up on our doorstep with Josh, A, and B, without the benefit of thinking about it, is the smart thing to do to get what you want.
I'll tell you, walking up to that door, every step I take, I'm dreading.
Okay, before I even get there. It's not you. You understand this, right? This is not you.
No, but it is. So just...
All right, fine.
So I'm walking there, right? I'm walking there with my buddy. Yeah, me and you are walking there to Lori's house.
I am not Josh. I'm Toby. I'm in an underpass with a homeless guy.
That's actually really funny. Yeah. I'm just dreading it. I know that what I'm doing is not going to end well, but I know I have to do it. And then I get there and I'm like, oh, here it goes. And then we open the door and she's all upset and she's just looking at me like she's upset. I feel like, though, she wouldn't have even agreed to see me if I told her the extent to what I was about to put her through.
That's totally possible. But I guess what I'm wondering is, and that's a fair point, but I guess what I'm wondering is if you make your case and allow it to sink in and then show up on her doorstep anyway.
No, because then as soon as she answers the door, it's going to be like a bomb went off. I told you not to come here. I'm not agreeing to this. Please get off my out of my property.
Right,
but
she says the same thing anyway.
Yeah, but at least we got in the door.
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I just... Ambushing someone is usually not the best way to get someone.
I totally agree.
Not giving them time to digest a complex thing, because this is a complex thing. They both have reasonable sides to their argument, you know?
But time is of the essence, too. I don't know.
Yeah, but it's nighttime. It's not like it's going to break in the next 5 minutes.
Right. I mean, I would have done it completely different.
If it were like this story is going to break like in a few hours, oh, absolutely, you got to drive over there.
Right.
Oh, 100%. All right, I'm just curious. So, all right, so then, Sam, I think to your point, and this is the reason why I wanted to get to this right away, is because I think to your point, Sam knows the way he speaks to her. Sam, when he wants to be passionate and big, in that last episode that we watched, the short list, when he's talking about like privacy to the president, when he kind of changes the president's mind, it's like, I'm talking about who's gay and who's not, and you know, on a country that was born to be free, what could be more, you know, what could be more better than this? He's very subdued.
Because he knows that he did something wrong.
He's very small. He's soft-spoken. And he's straight to the point. I don't remember exactly what he says, but he's like, okay, this is basically it. A friend of ours is in trouble, and we need your help, being in the world that you live in. And I think to your point, and to the point that we were both making, but most of your point, he knows there's nothing good in this. This is such a difficult circumstance. He just has to be as respectful as possible and just get through. Don't beat around the bush. Don't be cutesy, because he loves to be cutesy with her.
Yeah.
Not here.
No. Nope.
He's just... And again, I want to stress, I think he's trying to be both respectful as possible given the circumstances, and be succinct. And I think that tells you everything you need to know about how he feels, because this is a completely different way that he's dealing with Lori than we ever see him deal with her. Even in like difficult circumstances, when he fucking drops in on her at that bar, restaurant, whatever it was, he's still flirting with her, making jokes, this and that. Even though like he like scared her, as she said.
The thing is, you know why the what you're talking about is every situation we've seen him with, he's walked in with confidence. And this is the first time that we know he's not confident that he's going to, he's not confident with the outcome. Does that make sense?
Or even necessarily the high ground.
Right. I don't know if he's always had the high ground, because he's always behind the eight ball.
But he may have always felt that he had the high ground. I mean, he certainly feels like she should not be doing what she's doing in terms of the job. That I mean, he says it in almost every episode.
Yeah.
But I think this is, I mean, maybe we're just splitting a hair. Perhaps it's a hair worth splitting. I don't know. But it's just clear that he, to me, and I think this is what you were saying, it's just clear that there is no good in this. There's only, you have to do it. That's really all it is. You're at this place where, this has to be done. There is no morality back and forth. Now, I think a morality is placed on it, because then she shoots them down. She's like, so, are you guys for real? What?
So there's no objective scale to delineate variations of good. We can't say that one side is better than the other in this situation, but I do
Generally, I would say that. I mean, I think it's better. I think you can say it is better to feed a homeless person than to kill a homeless person, but
I don't know if you could. Yeah, I don't know.
I think we can generally agree to that. However, there is a way to skew that where that's not necessarily true.
Yeah, but I do, taking all that aside, you know, I do think that there is a net good to the situation. Good with air quotes. Good, like there is the right thing to do, yeah. And I think the only reason why they're there is because there is that net, this is the right thing that we should try.
Well, I'm with you, right? I agree. I think this is absolutely what they should do. And then when it gets later in the scene where it's like you're the good guys and this and that, it might be more in terms of how Josh dealt with it. But Lori clearly thinks less of Sam. So I think for Lori, and I think even for Sorkin, just asking Lori, this is not being a good guy, and you and I wouldn't agree with that, but we'll get there, because I just want to, you know, right after she says to him, or after the request that he makes, Lori then says, she basically says no, well, forget this ever happened,
right,
whatever.
Right.
And this is, Josh hasn't spoken to this point. Now, this is when Josh comes in and is like, you know, I recognize you from somewhere. How do I know you? I went to, you know, then they figure out that it's from, what episode was it? State Dinner. With that D-bag, Carl Everett. And this is one of the first times where I don't think Lori's argument makes much sense. And she says, you know, did you think only Republicans paid for kinky sex? My big issue with that is, A, it's hypocritical on her part for calling him out and being a hypocrite. And B, he's not being a hypocrite. So her argument makes no sense. And she's accusing Josh of doing. And if that sounds a little complicated, I get it. First of all, Josh is not pretending that only Republicans pay for sex. If anything, going to her, revealing that their guy is in trouble, is basically saying, we need to fight fire with fire. We know that our guy did something that's possibly less savory, so now we need someone else that did something on the other side of the aisle that did something that's less than savory, right?
So
for calling him out for being a hypocrite is kind of bullshit. Not to mention, she's basically saying to some guy, you know, how dare you come in here and ask this? All the while, she breaks the law willfully and wantonly. Like, that's kind of bullshit on her part.
I mean, so two things. One, logic's out the window. like, you know, that's what I'm saying.
That's why I preface this whole thing with, she hasn't really thought this through, and I totally get it. And this is necessary in the script because this is kind of what sets Josh off.
Right. Well, yeah. So there's that another quote, Tom Waits.
Watch out.
People do crazy things when they're wounded, or people say crazy things when they're wounded.
Yeah.
And they obviously came in here, took her by surprise, and she's hurt that Sam put her in the situation.
Right. And then it's going to get worse because Josh is going to do the exact same thing.
Yeah. Exactly. And so that. And then the other thing is, I don't know. Like, I'm all about Josh and Sam in this situation, but right. But Lori's hurt, and I have to. I don't. I'm torn. Like, I know that what they had to do is the right. What they had to do was go there and do what they had to do. But from Lori's perspective, she's hurt, and she's telling people. She's telling them that they hurt her. You know, and when someone tells you that...
Well, I don't know if Josh hurt her. It's Sam. Sam is the one.
Well, yeah, that's the whole thing. Sam's the linchpin in this whole situation.
Because he says, what are you, the brains in the outfit? And then she says, I can't believe you.
Right.
It's really focused there. And I get that. And that's why I give her all the room for her to drive through. But I'm talking about if we sit here and we have... In taking the characters out of it, because by the end of this scene, we're being told by the writer and the character that they're supposed to be the good guys and they're supposed to act like it. And I'm going to sit here and I'm going to tell you that nothing that Lori says to me makes any sense in the world, except for when Josh goes
over the line. You can't blame her for that.
I don't know how many times I have to say this to you. I don't blame her for that. I'm saying, outside of the characters and their own motivations, if we are going to have a discussion on morality, her arguments don't make sense. She's the hypocrite, and Josh is not being a hypocrite. She's accusing him of hypocrisy, yet she's the one, in my opinion, that's being hypocritical. And by the way, Josh is not being hypocritical. Right. He's coming into the circumstance saying, our guy fucked up.
Right.
So for her to say, do you think only their guys fuck up?
Well, that's
no,
how...
No, that makes no sense.
Maybe, I mean, I don't know, maybe
but
from a writing perspective.
It, she's saying it because she isn't... Because
but this is what she's perceiving from the situation.
Absolutely, and it's necessary so that then Josh can go off. What does he say after that? I don't feel like taking a civics lession from a hooker. And that's reasonable. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with how he said it.
Right.
But that's a reasonable sentiment. Yeah. Like, I don't really feel like someone being righteous to me who understands that they break the law and really don't care that they break the law. I don't care how you feel about prostitution, women, you know, the whole feminism argument of women using their bodies. That's a whole other separate discussion. The bottom line is she breaks the law willfully. And yet she's going to come down on this guy because they want a little piece of information. And Josh's other argument, which is also reasonable, if our tactics seem less than civilized, because so are our attackers. This is politics. This isn't, you know, this is for serious. I mean, this guy, Leo, is in trouble, you know? But then, of course, to your point, she says this, gets Josh going. It's necessary in the script, because then Josh just fucking... not just crosses the line, obliterates the line. Then he starts getting into the whole, you know, he threatens her.
Yeah.
With the
IRS comment, right?
Exactly, right. Which is a nice juxtaposition with Toby later on. Like, Toby's embarrassed by his power and Josh is just fucking flinging it all over the place. Talk about a metaphor. No, but he's just like, he's threatening her with the IRS. And then he makes that dig about, you know.
Her being a call girl.
Yeah. And that's the only time when I'm like, no, you're right on that, Lori. He totally did mean that.
And there's a difference, I think. There's a difference, but it's a subtle difference. And I don't know if it's noticed by a lot of people. I don't know if, you know, you could really split it far up. There's a difference between being defensive and being hurt.
What do you mean?
I think that up until this point, Lori has been defensive because she was... you know, kind of ambushed.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
And then after that last comment by Josh, that was hurtful. You know, and yeah. that comment that he made hurt her, and then after that, I think that he's wrong now by saying that, and I think like the whole scene kind of shifted.
Well, he's definitely wrong.
So I think, you know, I think up, you know, there is that split because you could defend against your position because in a way she was right for feeling like the way she felt until he said that line about, you know, being a prostitute and I'll just leave the money on the stand or whatever he said. Is that what you want? Money? If you want money, I could pay you money.
Right.
And then that's hurtful, I feel, you know, and then the only thing you could do at that point is just apologize.
Yeah, I think what you're trying to identify is that defensive. The biggest difference between defensiveness and hurtfulness is defensiveness comes out of a place of insecurity, and hurt comes out of a place of being wounded.
Maybe, and I don't know, like I said, just the psychological aspect is I think, you know, you need to be hurt first to even get to a position of defensiveness. You have to sense that notion of I'm being threatened in some
way.
Well,
yeah, I was just going to say, you're not necessarily hurt yet, but you're being attacked.
Right. There has to be some level of threat.
But usually defensiveness for me, insofar as I'm concerned, deals with insecurity, not being able to be like, huh, did I do wrong? It goes immediately to, I'm being attacked, fuck you.
Right. I mean, it's
I don't
natural...
even know if you're hurt yet.
Yeah.
You're just under the threat. So to me, that's insecurity because you're not even willing to look at the possibility that you're wrong.
It goes back to the fight or flight syndrome.
Right. But as opposed to being hurt, which is, I'm wounded. Whatever you just did really hurt me.
Right. You know? And I think that's what happened with that line.
Yeah, yeah. I think this scene really turned at that point because, you know, up until that point, I'm team Josh and Sam. You know, with all due respect to Lori, like, she can be indignant all she likes. I don't really give a fuck.
Yeah.
Once that happens, I can't defend Josh at all.
Yeah.
He totally crosses the line.
And Lori never outright says that you hurt me, Sam. You know, but you could tell that she's hurt.
Well, but yeah, I mean, yeah, you could tell that her, you know, I mean, I don't know that I would go, I mean, you know, you're hammering the hurt point. But it, to me, it's almost more of, it's a betrayal. Like, that's how I would characterize it. I feel like the way she's acting right now, she feels like she's been betrayed.
Right. And I think that Sam should be smart enough to know that when you've made somebody feel a certain way, you don't get to say that they shouldn't feel that way or they don't feel that way.
Well, and then that's another
point. All you can do is say you're sorry and try to move on.
Yeah, and you're not, I mean, sometimes that person is wrong, you know, because some people maybe are overly sensitive or literally misunderstood what you said or what have you. But
all that aside, even that, all that aside, you don't get to say that.
Well, I was just about to say, I mean, yeah. Before,
your feelings
before
are your feelings.
Well, right. Before you cut in, I was about to say, but the conversation ends if you don't validate someone's feelings. Like,
right.
If someone is hurt physically in pain, no matter what it is that you did and how it was supposed to be perceived or the way it should have been perceived, you have to at least acknowledge the fact that that person feels that way. And then you can move forward. Because if you don't acknowledge that, conversation's over.
Conversation's over.
You know, it's like everything else that we talk about. If you engage, you're better off than if you don't. You know?
And this is so easy speculating about it. Because I know when I'm in these situations, like, I don't know if I'm always the one to acknowledge another person's feeling.
Why?
I don't know, just the heat of the moment, you know, like, I'm sure that Josh and Sam know everything that we're talking about right now, and we know it because we're talking about it, but when we're put in that, in the moment, in that situation, in real life, I don't know if it's so easy to kind of remove yourself from the situation and be mature enough to acknowledge the other person's feeling when you're in a heated debate with them.
Yeah, that's fair.
And that's all I have to say.
Okay. All right. Well, after that, and I finished my sentence.
Period.
Okay. So then after that, Josh apologizes. And I guess, you know, you went out there and just split a hair. I'm going to split another one. Do you understand, see, care that there is a difference between hurting someone for the sake of hurting them and not meaning it versus hurting someone and meaning it. I guess the point is that Josh in this scene, I feel as though doesn't really mean what he says, doesn't really look down on call girls, Lori, doesn't really look down on her at all. But says that line because he apologizes. He says, in fact, I'm sorry. That was very rude. I feel like he said it to be a dick, to hurt her, to feel better, to feel more powerful, but doesn't really mean it, as opposed to having said it and actually meant it. Do you understand that hair that I just split?
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know which one's worse. I feel like I have done that in the past, that I've said things because I know it would hurt people, even though I didn't actually mean it. And as we were just talking about, I'm not sure it even matters to the person who is hurt by what you say. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think...
It might be worse to know that someone used something against you that you knew was going to hurt them. But on the other hand, it might comfort them to know that you don't really feel that way, as opposed to if they said something and really meant it. I don't know. I wonder if there is a difference in
the way it's perceived or the way it's dealt.
No, just ultimately at the end of the day, for the conversation, you know, for the people involved.
I think there is.
Yeah?
Yeah. I think that I'm trying to get this out. The way, if you're going to intentionally hurt somebody for the sake of hurting them, using hurt as a device, I think, is less severe than unconsciously or unintentionally hurting someone.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. What you're saying is what Josh did is not as bad as if he actually meant it.
See, now, that's a different thing because I don't know.
Wait, so that's not what you said?
No, that's what I said, but if you want to put it in terms of the context of Josh and Sam and Lori's situation, I think that Josh revealed how he actually feels, and he was a little embarrassed by that, and he knew what he did was wrong, and that's why he apologized. But I don't think that he intentionally said that to hurt her. I think in the heat of the moment, it just came out, and his true feelings, he showed his true colors. But I think that's different than what
you
asked.
I don't think that's right. So, okay. So, yeah, we're talking about two different things.
Yeah.
You're saying that if you said something to hurt somebody but didn't actually mean it, that is not as bad as actually meaning it.
If you use hurt as a device to hurt.
Right.
I think that that's
not
less,
as bad.
Not as bad.
Okay.
Than unintentionally doing
but,
something.
But now that's the first thing. And I don't know that I agree with you. I think I lean that way. Because I would like to think that if someone said something that was hurtful towards me, I would hope that they actually really didn't believe it. No matter what the cost would be at the expense of knowing that they would use something intentional to hurt me. But there is a second thing that you brought up, which is, you think that Josh actually means what he said.
I do.
See, I don't. Interesting. Okay. Why do you think he actually meant it?
Because you in a situation like that, and we saw how emotionally fired up Josh was.
I would say emotionally compromised, but go ahead.
He is...
What?
I just want to hit you sometimes.
Why?
I don't know.
Well, I don't understand. Emotionally compromised to me means that he doesn't have the ability to think reasonably. So I think that is a rational thing.
I think
that
what
he
we're talking about is the same thing.
Right, but you think that he means it, and I don't think he meant it. I think he said it because he wants to inflict pain on her. Like, shut the fuck up. Are you kidding me? You're calling me a hypocrite? Look in the mirror.
Right, so that's what I'm saying.
You want money? Here's money.
Exactly. That's my point. Yeah. He's so emotionally fired up
right.
that he is going to be as blatant and honest. He's not thinking about what he's saying.
Oh, see,
it's just a word vomit.
That's not, see, right. We're getting to that point. Right. Word vomit. Exactly. Yeah. He's just regurgitating. It's not a true representation of his opinions.
Perhaps yes, it's a it true is.
Right,
yes,
right.
It is.
I know that you're saying that. What I'm saying is that I think he's just trying to just fucking, it's a verbal punch in the face.
But
and
when
it has
you,
nothing to do with what he actually believes.
Yes, it does. Because
no,
if you,
I know that that's what you're saying. But what I'm saying is I don't think it has anything to do with what he actually believes.
I know.
Right.
I know, but that's what you think.
Right. So then, but give me.
That's what I'm trying to do, but you keep on telling me what you think.
No, I know. What I'm saying is that I'm trying to base it in terms of how the scene goes, and you're like, no, that's not how the scene goes. So tell me how you feel the scene goes.
No, that's how the scene goes. But I'm telling you what I think is going on in Josh's head.
Right, which is?
Which is that when you don't have control over what you're saying, because he doesn't at this moment, because his emotions are just flying. You're just going to say the first thing that comes to your mind, and the first thing that comes to your mind is what you truly feel.
So then how is it possible to say something hurtful for the purpose of being hurtful?
Because that's what I'm saying. If you're going to use hurt, you're in control. It's a directed...
So you're saying it's... Then the only time, in your opinion... This is what I'm trying to get at.
Okay.
This is why I keep saying, no, let's... Your argument then is that... The only way that you can ever hurt someone purposefully, but not believe it, is calculated. It can't be done spur of the moment. That's your argument.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I can devise a hurtful comment towards you and launch it, but I know the only reason why I would do that is for X reason, and I'm gonna do just this much. You know, you have no control over when it comes intentionally. And you don't know the actual hurt that you're inflicting when you do it unintentionally.
But so then your argument, because this is what I'm trying to get to. Then your argument is that if you are emotionally compromised and yes. you cannot control what you're saying, that to you is the representation of how you actually feel.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't agree with that. Yeah.
Hmm.
I think, I don't necessarily. In fact, I think most of the time when you do that, is not representative of how you really feel. I feel like your emotional life is very different than your intellectual opinions.
No, I think that, you know, when you have a better head on your shoulders, you're able to filter, you know, what's appropriate for any given situation. And
I think you can also reason.
Right. And when that filter is gone and when that reason is out the window, you're going to say what's truly on your mind.
You're going to say how you... Well, that's right. So that's how you feel. I feel as though in those moments, your ego, your id, your child, your whatever it is just free to unleash without any sort of... without the benefit of intellect. And I think intellect is really where opinions are formed.
The ego regulates the id and the super ego. Like, all right, let's not get all psychological, right? But yeah, when you don't have the regulation component in the situation, when your ego is removed, right? And you're just pure sheer emotion.
Yeah.
Think of like...
I don't know that that's true. You're saying it is true and I'm saying I don't know that
it's interesting.
It is true.
I like that. I like that we're not matching on this.
Yeah, I just don't... I feel as though... I don't know that that's... I mean...
It almost goes back to like... you ever hear that another quote? Boom.
Hey.
A drunken mind speaks a sober heart.
Yeah.
And I feel like when you're drunk on emotions...
Right. Except that I also believe that that's bullshit. Huh. I believe that when I'm drunk, I'm no more truthful than when I am when I'm sober. In fact, I think it heightens...
your candidness.
Bullshit emotions.
Well, maybe. I've
become attracted to a lot of women that I'm not really attracted to.
I agree.
There have been amplified feelings of morose and happiness that aren't as real as when I'm sober. I think it amplifies whatever exists. I think it can amplify truth, but I think it can also amplify lies.
Hmm.
And I think that's the same. And I think that's the same circumstance with being emotionally Like, he's just so fucking angry right. that he can't help his boss that when this person pokes him, he punches her in the face verbally.
Yeah.
I don't think he really believes it.
I do.
I know. So, we'll have to agree to disagree.
We'll have to
Should
agree
we handshake?
Disagree. I don't know. My hands are all sweaty.
Then that's a no. Okay. So,
I should have just shook your hands.
I know.
Hands.
Yeah, I'd be like, ooh, clammy hands. Get them out of your pants. Okay, so.
Stop looking down there.
So now we get to the point, and I think this is maybe the end of where we want to go with this scene, which is, why are you shaking your head?
No, go on.
What?
No, go on.
No, you're shaking your
no,
head?
No, go ahead.
Okay. You're supposed to be the good guys. Basically, Sorkin is saying, I think this is why Sorkin's a really good writer in...
Hey, Joe, do you think Sorkin's a good writer?
Sorkin? Who is that?
He's a writer.
Oh. I don't know. I'll have to see some of his
all
work.
Right, yeah.
I'm going to say that I'm undecided. He gives you a very complex argument... And then gives you a very simple ending. And I know that sounds really stupid to say that that's what makes him a good writer. But I think that the reason why a lot of people like the show is because it has a sense of morality and idealism and all that other shit. And I think a lesser writer probably would have made the entire scene about how Josh was a dick. As opposed to giving Josh a very solid, sound, reasonable argument. And then allowed the emotions and the circumstance to take him completely off the rails, which then allows for the nice clean ending. Because, you know, he likes the nice clean ending. Clearly the people that watch The West Wing like it.
See, but that's the beauty of it. You can sum up, I think. Mm. I think that last line, you're supposed to be the good guys, that sums up the whole scene in a nutshell of what the audience is actually thinking in their
right.
head.
Right, and I think you and I disagree with that.
What?
You and I believe that they have been good guys.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
That what they have done is not, in our opinions, them being bad guys. Outside of Josh crossing the line.
Yeah.
We can establish that Josh crossing the line is not him being a good guy.
Yeah.
But I really bristle at the idea that them coming to Lori and asking this is them not being good. It really bothers me that that could be perceived in any way as them not being good. I would have done exactly what they did, and I would not expect them to do anything else. Now, does that mean that Lori has to agree? Absolutely not. She can have her own opinions, and she does, and she's entitled to them, and she's not wrong. But being good it's not always black and white. And I think that is, I feel like, what people may come away with, that they should have never been there in the first place. And I think that's bullshit.
Hmm. Yeah, I agree. I mean, what he's doing is kind of like trying to put us on one side or the other. And like you said, I don't think it's that black and white.
I don't know if he's trying to do that, but that's certainly how people end up.
Absolutely. And
because
he's exploiting
it's just,
that. He's
just
using
it's
that.
It's much more simple. It's easier. It's easier to be like, oh, they're right. Oh, they're wrong. Mm-hmm. As opposed to straddle the gray and the middle and the inside.
I always like there's a little framework I've heard. I don't even remember where I learned it, but there's essentially three types of people.
Right.
There's good people, bad people, and nice people.
Okay.
And I don't think that, you know, on the spectrum of this good, bad, and nice in the middle type thing, I think that it's more gradient than that. I think that there's more variance in between.
Sure.
But if you just want to really simplify it to good, nice, and bad, you know, good people don't compromise their feelings for others all the time. You know, they're true to who they are. Nice people always put others ahead of themselves. They mm-hmm. always
defer.
Yeah, and bad people are like Lilienfeld.
Right.
You know, so yeah, I mean if we just use that simple framework, they are the good people, even if you just want to use that as a lens.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And Lori is the same way too. Lori is another good person, but she's not compromising her own opinions for the sake of others.
Yeah.
You know, she's upfront, she's candid, and she's being transparent.
Yeah, and there's nothing to say that there's not this isn't, and I think this is why this makes it difficult for me to be like, you know, they're not being the good guys. You don't have to have someone be wrong in order for there to be someone to be right.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and so it's a circumstance in which I have no problem with Lori having her opinion, telling them no, and being like pissed about the circumstance. I have no problem with any of that. But it doesn't mean then that what they did was wrong, again, outside of Josh crossing the line, you know? And I think it's very, I think you get in a very dangerous place. I would feel very, like if I were Sam, I would just remind Josh, hey, until you like cross the line, what we did wasn't wrong. You know, I would hate to think that they would throw the baby out with the bathwater in this circumstance, or that someone would come away from this and think to themselves, you know, you should always be able to know what the right thing is right away. Even if you want to say that they're wrong, what they getting to the place, that's the other thing. It's like
process, I think, is more important than the outcome.
Process is so important. And I think people, especially today, people aren't allowed to, and I'm not even saying what they did was a mistake, but people aren't allowed to make mistakes. People are not allowed to try and figure out what the best way is. I mean, it really bothers me that you're supposed to be the good guys is a dig, like what they did was wrong.
Right.
And even if it was, this is a very difficult thing.
Yes.
A father figure is in such peril. Cut the fucking guys a little slack. I'm not talking about Lori. I'm talking about Sorkin now.
Yeah.
And I think he does. I just hope that the audience comes away and realizes that. That it's not as simple as, okay, Leo's got this problem. What should we do? Definitely don't go to Lori because then we would be bad guys. What we should do it. Like, that's not how it works. Like, right. When bad stuff happens, you fucking scramble. Your head's all over the place. Like, it's not as clean and as simple as... you should be good guys.
Right, but I think that's the beauty in the writing.
Yes.
Because that's what it creates for us.
Yeah. I just hope people get that.
Yeah, I'm sure they do. And even if they don't willingly acknowledge it, they feel it.
Yes. All right, so we both agree that they are being good guys. Good. Good.
Good.
What else you got on Samuel?
Samuel Beckett. I don't know, I just like saying
that
name.
Which one? Quantum Leap Samuel Beckett or the writer Samuel Beckett?
The writer Samuel Beckett.
What play did he write that I love? I don't know. I'm going to have to get back to you on that. There's a play. It's like 5 pages. It's so good. Okay. I think it's time to move on.
I think it's time to move on to your boy.
All right. Are you ready to talk about my man?
Let's talk about your man.
Tobias Ziegler. All right. So Toby's thing is just... This is the heartbeat of the episode. This is everything about this episode to me. It's not. Come on now.
To you.
So Toby, it starts with him and the coat. And he goes to the crime scene because the card is in the coat that the homeless man has and is dead. And this journey, let me preface it by saying I believe this journey to be a very solitary one for Toby. And it increasingly gets so, and may cause him to go to the lengths that he ultimately does. I don't know how you feel about that. I'm going to try and...
Say it again? You kind of...
His journey is a solo one in this. He's getting very little help from anyone he asked for. Well, right, but I'm not talking about generally. I'm talking about specifically in this problem, in this issue.
It's a Toby
problem. But he's not getting any help. And so because he seems to not get help at every turn or not get the satisfaction that he wants, it just propels him forward more and more and more. So it starts with being at the memorial. Which, by the way, I mistook it for the Vietnam Memorial, and it's not. It's the Korean that Anthony accurately said it was. And I should know not to question Anthony on Southeast Asia. How many Southeast Asian girlfriends have you had?
Oh, my God. One.
Well, is that it?
That's
then
it.
How come every time it's like...
Oh, my God.
No, it's... Come on now.
No, it's one.
Is it only one?
It's only one.
All right. I thought it was more. Well, because
holy moly.
The one girl... That's at the restaurant. there's the other girl at the restaurant.
At the restaurant?
Yeah, where we were. All right.
Oh, I see.
There's two there. There's one that was interested. There was one that... All right. You know what? I don't want to blow up any spots. You know,
yeah, thank you.
Let's just suffice it to say, I should have deferred to him. So...
That's right.
I should have. And I do. And I even said to you, I apologize. You got it right.
Who's your daddy?
My father is Vincent, and he is not here right now. So basically what you have is that happened and the soul, what's that?
I said, I can't believe I just said, who's your daddy?
I know. I don't know what's wrong with you. There's the detective who's really not that interested in getting the, I mean, he says it's not a high priority. Even after Toby points out that he was in Korea, the guy doesn't care. The detective doesn't care. And Toby's kind of shocked by that. The next time you see him, he's on the phone with the VA, I believe, and he's being put on hold when Mandy gets to come in and say something stupid yet again. Great character, that Mandy. So those are two instances, law enforcement and a VA, that seem to frustrate, not pay the kind of attention, respect. He's not getting what he thinks this guy is deserving of, right? Then he finds himself in a conversation with John Noonan at the memorial again. And that conversation was just so fucking good. And I think it's played so small that it doesn't really, you know.
John Noonan was the guy in the stand.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, Toby's looking around like he's, I don't know. Like he's like a con. He actually is looking around like he's maybe even a drug dealer. I don't know what he's doing.
Yeah, he looks like he's doing something sketchy.
He is. He's looking around very like, I don't know if he's looking for somebody in particular, but he goes up to this guy.
But you know what? It's indicative of his character in this episode.
I mean, he's very awkward. It's uncomfortable. Yes, that's exactly right. And it's clear that he's, you know, really awkward. He's looking around. John asks if he's looking for something. I don't know if he says something in, you know, particular or whatever. Toby's like, I'm not a cop. And then he asks him about Walter Hufnagel, the guy that died. John says that he knew him, and I love that he asks him if he was a friend of his, and Toby says no. This is, and I think he says something like, "Yeah, I didn't think so." This kind of idea recurs again later on. Just this idea that, you know, like what are you are you his friend? Because why do you care? That right. kind of thing. Like seemingly no one cares about these people. Why do you care about this
mm-hmm,
guy?
Mm-hmm.
Toby tells him that he's just trying to find someone that might know or that might be interested that he died. John gives him a lead by telling him to go to some place a lot of people hang out. It's under a bridge, as it turns out. But Toby thanks him and is about to walk away. Like he leans away and then turns back and is like, "Are you a veteran?" John says, "Yes." Toby introduces himself with a handshake. John does the same thing in kind. He says, "Merry Christmas." Toby says to John, "Merry Christmas." And then John says, "Merry Christmas" back in the most subdued, shocked way. Like he just can't believe the conversation he just had. And really not a lot transpired. But what did transpire was, "I want to know what your name is. I want to shake your hand. And I want to wish you a Merry Christmas."
You know, when it was just amazing, like watching that scene, it wasn't like I was watching an actor's.
Yeah.
You know, do that. Like I've seen that expression from the guy in the booth in life.
Yeah.
Like that, just that face.
Yeah.
You know, like the little head tilt he did. Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, I don't know. For me, that was a great scene.
It is a great scene. And it's just a touching moment. I mean, it
was touching.
It reminded me of that element in this episode of how, I think you said it before we started recording, about how it brings out their humanity, because you're constantly looking at all of these things from the characters' perspectives that we know.
Yeah.
You know, it's Toby's journey and we're looking at it through Toby. But just in that sentiment of that Merry Christmas with that deep appreciation / shock, it's almost like, right. There's his point of view too. Don't forget their point of view too. Because we're enveloped with Toby's.
But that point right there is exactly what we're seeing play out and what we just talked about with Sam, Laurie, and Josh.
But at least we're primed to know Laurie more. This is her fourth, fifth appearance. This is the first time we see this guy. This is the only scene he ever has in this show. And I, there's a reason why this is one of my favorite episodes. One of the reasons is this scene, and the reason why it's the scene is because of that guy.
Yeah.
That is just, I mean,
it was genuine.
What a way to make a mark.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way that that actor is listening to this, and I wish I knew his name so I can give him a shout out.
We could probably find.
Maybe we could. All I know is that was so phenomenally done, it has stuck with me all these years later.
Yeah. You remind me of my uncle. If you're listening.
Me? Oh, no, him. I was going to be like, why? Does your uncle like this episode too?
No, I don't know. I don't know.
All right, so then that's just a great scene.
Just look
for the subtleties and the smallness of it. And Toby actually finally gets a lead. And now we get to the big scene under the bridge. Is that song by...
Yes.
What's that group?
I don't know.
Red Hot Chili Peppers.
Yes.
I hate that song. All right. Scene under the bridge. I still hate that song, though. So you get... Toby finds out... He goes to the place. There's the line. And he asks, anybody know Walter Hufnagel? He finds out the brother is over there. And he finds out that he's a little slow. So he goes over. I think something that was really telling almost right away was how Toby's like, excuse me. And before he can even say, you know, are you... Mr. Hufnagel or whatever. As soon as he says, excuse me, the one guy just gets up and walks away, being like, what the fuck is this guy in this suit doing here?
See, that was my point before we started recording.
Like, what?
That's just a glimpse of their reaction into their human condition.
Right.
Right? Like, who is this guy? Like, we know that this guy's probably up. Like, this is not going to end well for us.
Right, right. Because when people like him expecting. Come down here, right, yeah. right, right. No, absolutely, that's, absolutely.
Yeah,
and it also plays out with John Noonan before
absolutely.
When he's like, you know, are you a friend of his? Like, why could you possibly care that a veteran died? And it comes up again in a little bit. But yeah, the guy gets up and leaves. Toby finally has George, I think, is his name. He tells him that his brother died. George has a visible reaction, slow or not. That other guy from the line before comes back. And then they kind of get into how does he know him, you know, and Toby says he had a coat that I was wearing. And then the one guy that was on the line, we'll call him Mustache Guy cause he doesn't have a name. Mm-hmm. Mustache Guy is like, do you want your coat back? I fucking love that line because, again, that just took both of the points that we just made and just threw it over the top. What could this guy, meaning Toby, care about this veteran that died? Oh, he probably wants his coat back.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I think that propels Toby doesn't have to then go. Toby delivered the message. He's dead.
Yeah.
Right? Your brother's dead. He could just say, no, I don't need the coat back. I just wanted you to know and I'm leaving. But what does he do next? He starts to tell George about how his brother was in Korea and he was a veteran.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I were the actor and I was tracking it and the way I was watching the scene, the way it looks to me is, I just told you that this guy died. His brother can't fully understand and you're asking me whether or not I want a coat. Does no one give a shit that this guy was in Korea?
Right.
And that is that someone needs to pay attention to this or whatever? And then I think that's why he then goes into your brother was in Korea. And Toby tries to explain, you know,
the whole Purple Heart thing.
Yeah, everything. And it's actually interesting. If you watch the scene, it starts to slow zoom in on Toby as he starts to explain Korea to George. But when it cuts back to George... George is still in a medium. There is no zoom on that. To me, that's the director telling you this is all for... It's like Toby is trying... They're focusing on Toby. They're bringing Toby bigger and bigger and bigger. And when you go back to George and it's still the same shot, it's clearly not landing.
Yeah.
And then it's represented in the dialogue. you know, what does he say? He's like, you know, your brother was in, he fought in Korea. And he's like, no, he didn't mean it, I'm sure. No, a lot of people fought in Korea.
Were you there?
Yeah. And then that's the penultimate line, because then when it's, were you there, it's a cut to Toby close up. And just like, no, I wasn't.
He just then realized
that. Yeah, it's like, and this is what my point is. Because after this, it's just, you know, a little bit of, I just want to let you know I'm sorry. And, you know, there weren't enough beds. You know, okay, have a good night. All right, I'm sorry. And then he's about to leave, and then he turns around and he does the honor guard thing. But for me at this point, that final close-up after were you there? He just said it was 45 years ago.
Right.
So when he says that, and clearly everything that he's trying to convey is not landing, I think this exemplifies Toby's lonely journey in this episode. He finally gets what he wants, someone that actually cares, and it still can't resonate. I think that's the purpose by making the brother slow.
Well, yeah, I saw the brother being slow as like a mirror to Toby.
How so?
Because Toby's lost this whole episode.
Right.
And it all came to a head when he found the slow brother who didn't know what was going on either.
Right.
So I just feel like that there was some type of connection there between, you know, it coming to a head at somebody who's lost or can't focus or can't be understood or can't understand.
Right.
And Toby, who's been trying to find himself the whole episode.
Right, that's fair. Yeah, I mean, he definitely is. And I really do. I mean, I get that sense from him that he's just so frustrated at this point that he can't.
Yeah, nobody's understanding
Toby. Get to wherever
Toby.
He can. And it's, and in some cases, it's not understanding. In some cases, he can't get someone on the phone. And in another case, someone does understand and just doesn't give a shit. That's the detective, obviously. I don't know. You know, when you're on such a journey that happens so incidentally, the guy had a coat that had his card in it, and you work so hard and diligently to try and get something out of it, to squeeze blood from a stone, you know, and it doesn't happen. I think that's what makes Toby just finally go, you know what? Fuck it. Your brother deserves an honor guard. And I think that's why he finally just couldn't have enough. He had enough. No one could do what he could do. And then this is that nice mirroring image. Or not mirroring, I don't want to use your word, that juxtaposition with Josh from before. Josh is throwing his weight around. Toby says, you don't know who I am. I'm an influential person. And then he can't even get out the words, I'm a very powerful person. He like turns away, he's rubbing his head, his face goes down, his voice gets muffled.
Yeah.
He's so embarrassed by saying that, whereas Josh is just throwing it out for all the world to see.
Right.
But he just can't stand it anymore. He has to do something for this guy. It's just, I fucking love this so much. This whole journey that he's on is just, Toby's my man. He is. He's my boy.
I actually love the whole last part of that scene when he tried to walk away.
Oh, and then he gives him the money.
And then they were like, no, man, you need to take the bus home.
Yeah.
Like, no, you take it. And he was like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, he doesn't know what to do. Yeah, he's like so flustered. And it's like, I guess I do need some money to go home. And it's just, that's a.
Have you ever given a homeless man money and they give it back to you?
No. I've had generally, I don't really wait around too long. I don't usually give money. Usually I'll buy something and give it to them, food or whatnot. And unfortunately, money isn't as plentiful as it was in years past. But my soft spot is when I see someone with like a dog or a cat. I will go to a store and buy dog food or cat food and also get some food for them and drop it off. But I mean, give it back? No, I've had people be like, I don't eat this.
Really?
Yeah. What? Not many times. I mean, but it's happened once or twice. I mean, it's New York, so I'm sure you're going to get that every now and again.
Yeah.
Have you given money? Do you give money?
No, I do. I try. I don't know. I like to.
Yeah, I have no idea whether or not it makes a difference, but
I think I think I made a difference once in this guy's life. Out of all the times I've given money.
Okay. What happened?
I don't know if it did or not. I was buying flowers for my girlfriend at the time, and I was walking out of the store, and it was Christmas time, it was freezing.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy, the homeless guy, came over to me and was like, "Those are really nice flowers." And I was like, "Yeah, I know. I picked them out."
Wow, so you were a dick to him first. Okay.
No, I said that in my head. Oh. And I was like, and I gave the guy, I pulled apart the bouquet and I gave him half the flowers. And I also threw him $20. And, you know, I went on my day, whatever. And the next day I came back and I saw the guy. And he was in the same spot, and he actually had the flowers out, like, displayed, like, in his little...
Really?
In his little area that he was, like, living in.
That's cute.
Yeah, it was just adorable. And like, he waved to me, like...
Really? He remembered you?
Yeah, and he didn't ask me for money. He was just sitting there in his little, like a cardboard box or whatever with the flowers. And he must have bought something to eat or something with the money I gave him.
For every story like I have where someone's like, "Oh, I don't eat that," you have a story like that.
It was touching. And you know, I wonder what happened to him. You know, I always wonder what happens to people.
Yeah, there was one homeless guy, Jimmy, in New York. Jimmy, he would always ask for money for his trip to Hawaii. He's like, "I'm saving up to go to Hawaii." And then he would, my buddy would wear a Nautica hat and he would call him Mr. Nautica. And then he would have an Echo shirt and the symbol of Echo was rhinoceros. And he was like, "Mr. Rhinoceros," is what he would always say. I love Jimmy. He would always wear headphones that weren't plugged into anything. They were just like dangling. Jimmy was great. He was actually a very nice guy. Yeah, I wonder what, yeah.
I wonder if he ever made it to Hawaii.
I don't know. I hope he did. Might be still on 7th and 13th or 12th is where I used to see him all the time, 7th Ave. Mr. Jim A. I love Jim A. But so then we get to the very end of Toby's journey. And that involves Mrs. Landingham and the president. And Mrs. Landingham says it twice. "You should not have done that. You should absolutely not have done that." I like the absolutely added. It makes it so crystal clear. She says, you know, did you, Toby, arrange for an honor guard in the president's name? You should not have done that. She is so fucking stern. And I think you know, we talked about it the last episode with her story about her kids, but I think you get the feeling that she thinks Toby is not fucking around, but abusing the, I mean, obviously he's abusing, you know, power that he doesn't have, but she seems almost offended by it. And I like her reaction.
Really? You think she was offended by it?
I don't know. I'm saying, like, when you first watch it, I'm like, why is she taking such a hard stance? Like, why does she... She's just the secretary of the president.
Right.
I mean, I'm sure she knows certain things or whatever. You know, like if CJ was pissed about it, that's one thing. If Josh was pissed about it, that'd be another thing. Just given her story, it's like, okay, why? That's weird that she's so... But I think it actually comes full circle when he gets done with his talk with the president, when she says, you know, "Can I come?" Because to me, it's the head and the heart, you know?
Yeah.
And even that conversation that Toby has...
That was touching.
Even the conversation that Toby has with the president, you know, it's a personal journey for Toby, and it's clearly one that's motivated by something that's going on inside him. Personal, not a big thing. But if Sam is going to be the moral compass, Toby is the political ideology compass, as it were. And, you know, the president's like, "Hey, how's it going? You know, just let me know. Are we out of NATO or did I agree to anything else?" And he says, you know, "Toby, look, I understand you can't blame yourself, but if we do this, how many other veterans are going to crawl out of the woodwork?" And then Toby just does not blink, is staring at him the entire time and says, "I can only hope, sir." And to me, in that moment, you just realize how it's gone from this personal thing to a much broader, bigger issue about veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And something that maybe, I mean, as someone in politics, he probably cared about, but probably not in the way that he does now.
Right.
The first minute from the 42nd minute are probably two different versions of his caring about veterans. Has that ever happened to you where something so ancillary brought you into contact with the world that then it became so much bigger for you? That's a big question.
Yeah.
Putting you on the spot.
Yeah, do you got something?
Well, yeah. I mean, I hate to always bring up veganism as that, but it's the biggest thing. Just because I guess the aspect of animal rights that I haven't said is the reason why I'm vegan is because of my dog. Mm-hmm. And my ex-girlfriend made me get this dog. I had never had a pet. I used to be one of those people that joked like, yeah, I love animals on my plate. Like that would be a joke that I would say. Mm. And I was like, oh, animals are this, that, they're gross, blah, 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 blah. And my girlfriend's like, we're getting a dog. I'm like, you know what? I'm not fucking walking this thing. I'm not feeding it. I'm not bathing it. I'm not doing anything with it. Fast forward 9 months later, we break up and I'm in love with this thing. And just that turned into me not being able to look into the eyes of any animal and not see my dog. So like from, you know, I don't know what year it was, but it was February when we adopted him. From February of that year to like a year and a half later, not even a year later, my world changed. And it was just this ancillary. If she had never, I sometimes wonder what would have happened if she never made me get a dog, or if I never dated her. Would have I ever have gotten to this point? And I don't know that I would have.
Hmm.
It's just strange. Like, what if Toby took the card out of his coat?
Right.
He never would have gotten that call. Right. You know, if he never donated the coat, if that guy got a different coat, you know, all these things. It's just funny to see how like life can set you on off on these trajectories. They don't have to be big things, you know?
Right.
My girlfriend just wanted a dog. Now animal rights is like one of the biggest things in my life.
Yeah.
That's bizarre. It's hugely bizarre.
Yeah.
I want you to have one.
I want one too.
All right. Maybe we'll do that as like an addendum, because if you don't have one now.
I'm trying to think. I mean, there's been a lot of things that I've hit a crossroads in life where I had to make a choice, and if I didn't make those choices, I wouldn't be where I am today.
Right.
And it's, I don't know.
But I'm even talking about like something that someone kind of did to you. You know. All right. Well, let me think about it. Yeah. I think the last thing that I want to talk about in terms of Toby's journey is just that supremely wonderful. This is the first time I had ever seen an honor guard. Playing to the little drummer boy, first of all, was incredible. But the precision that these guys used to do the honor guard was, it's so moving to me. It's unreal. Just, you know, I remember they're taking the casket out and they like less than a quarter. It's like a slight turn. Then they all move a slight turn and then they all move a slight turn.
I wonder if they got real people to do that.
I would almost think that they had to.
Because, yeah, I my grandfather died and I had to go to one of these things.
You went? Is it like that?
Not my grandfather, my uncle.
Oh.
I have an uncle in each branch of the military, in the Marines, in the Air Force, in the Navy, in the Army. And when one of them died...
Was this uncle the Marines?
Yeah, it was.
Because this was the Marines, yep. Too.
And he...
Was it like that?
It was, I'll tell you, down almost exactly.
And then they must have gotten... I mean,
I think he got a Purple Heart, too.
How moving. How moving is that scene? Oh, my God.
And you know what? It caught my eye immediately, too. What? Those gunshots.
Yeah.
Because I remember as a kid, when I heard those gunshots... It was the loudest, scariest thing that I've ever heard. Because it's a 23-gun salute, right?
Or 21.
21-gun salute. It's like 21 rifles going
I think
off.
I think it's only 7 rifles, and they do it 3 times.
Well, whatever it was, makes it 21. It's scary.
No, well, I mean, if it's right there, it's
a... Yeah, it was so loud. It really shook my head, and I'll never forget how I felt looking at that.
Well, I think... I actually have a follow-up question for you on that. Fun fact regarding that is that I believe Toby... Richard Schiff was really worried about that. I'm trying to remember where I read this. This is a while ago. His reaction is kind of a, not a goofy one, but it's not in keeping with the tone of the scene.
Yeah.
That's Richard Schiff breaking character because he wasn't prepared for how loud it was. But I think it was something like the directors felt that it was really important to keep it in there because it was so genuine and it was meant to convey, you know, the impact of not just the moment, but the sound of those guns. So just a little fun fact about that. I'm sure you can look it up. But I think Richard Schiff was worried that that was going to undercut the scene. And I think everybody, including myself, thinks that it only enhances it. And I really do. I think it brought an element of realism to that moment. But I want to ask you about, if it's okay, your uncle. Because that's, I mean, how old were you when you went to this?
Oh, man. I had to be like 7 or 8, maybe even, no, probably around, maybe older. I would say maybe like 9.
Could you understand the impact of what was happening, or the import, I should say?
I just remember it was a big to-do.
Yeah.
I don't think I realized, I mean, I'm a different person now when I look back at
it. Yeah.
But yeah, no, I don't think I realized how big of an impact it was. I knew how much he meant to my dad in particular. He was his brother.
Right.
But what he did for the world, you know, like, I don't...
Right.
I didn't realize that.
So impact. Besides the guns, what do you remember most?
The flag. The folding of the flag.
The folding of the flag?
Yep.
Folding I'm of telling the flag. You, everything...
And carrying the casket. My dad had to help carry this casket.
I've never been to one of these, so I only have this episode to go by. The reverence with which they do this, first of all, is clearly what Toby has been seeking this entire episode for this man that's died, and perhaps for all veterans by the end of it. So I think the impact that it leaves is perfect, both for the audience and for Toby's journey. But this is difficult for me to put into words. It's just one of those things where, you know, it might not be the best ending as far as writing is concerned, because it has nothing to do with writing. It has everything to do with how it's shot, how it's performed, the music that's being played. It is one of the most lasting memories I have of this show, is this final scene.
Really?
Without a doubt. And it's why this episode is one of my favorites, and it just moves me every time I watch it. Huh. That folding, the way he curls it into his chest, just everything about it. And I am not rah-rah America, soldier, this and that. I am not that person. But it is, I mean, it's a thing, man. You know, and I really do, it's moving.
Yeah.
And I'm with you on that.
I gotta circle back with my dad and talk to him about that.
Yeah, you
that.
Should. I mean, that's
or just learn more about. I want to learn more about my family like that, because I know that we have a big family.
Yeah,
I mean, we probably did a lot of things that I should know.
Yeah, you might. I mean, yeah, why not?
Right?
Might find some stuff you're not that happy about.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know what it might be, but all right. So I think that. Do you have anything else on Toby?
No, that's it.
All right, so let's finish this up with a little gift talk, shall we?
Sure.
The theme of the episode, it's not the theme of the episode, it's so minor in it, it's about gift giving.
Christmas.
How do you feel about gift giving, buddy?
Gift giving?
Yeah.
Who doesn't like to get a gift or give a gift?
I do, but I feel like sometimes it gets out of hand.
What do you mean?
Well, at Christmas, it's like you always got to do something. It's like... when you do something really good, you have to outdo it the next year, and you have to outdo it the next year.
Yeah.
And then by the time you get there, you're like, oh, shit, I'm spending $5,000 this year on 5 people.
Yeah.
Like, that's not – I mean, it got – I remember, like, I got an old print of a movie that my sister likes on, like, 16 millimeter, so she could always watch it on 16 millimeter. And then the next year from my other sister, she's a big fan of Abraham Lincoln – I got her an original newspaper from when he was inaugurated. I got my mother an antique map from Italy it cost a lot to frame, because I got museum glass so that it wouldn't degrade from the sunlight if it hit it. It's like, it gets so extreme. And like, I didn't start out like this. It started out with like normal shit.
Yeah, yeah.
But you just want to, you know, outdo year after year. And then we all looked at each other a few years ago and like, why are we giving each other shit that we don't need?
Yeah.
Shouldn't we just...
I mean, it's
spend
nice.
Spend time?
Yeah, that's the key.
Because that's really what it comes... I mean, because like, I love the fact that Donna wants all these things in this episode.
Right.
But the thing that really probably makes the most impact is the note.
The note in the book.
And that's it. I mean, that to me is it.
Yeah.
Are you still in the... Like, we don't give each other gifts in my family.
Yeah, we give gifts and... I think my parents are trying to do that. You know, they're moving more towards let's have an experience together and have a lasting memory like that instead of giving something material. I remember one year I got, I was a kid. It was a robot that was able to walk up walls. It was like,
how is that even possible?
It was like a cool like robot toy, like one of these like zany brainy type toys.
Zany brainies.
And I literally broke it in 6 seconds.
That's amazing.
Like, I opened it and I broke it. And then I looked at my parents. It was, like, really cool, too. And I looked at my parents and I was like, it broke.
Aww.
That's all I did. And I was like, you know, I was like, I don't know, like 16, 17. Like, I don't know. Like,
that's so funny.
There's a lot of thought that went into that gift, and I broke.
Well, that's...
I didn't even take responsibility for it. I was just like, it broke.
I didn't do it. It broke. Someone else did it.
Yeah.
Oh, that's sad.
I know.
That's not that sad. Well, I'm glad that they're... I mean, look, to each their own, and everybody do their own thing. It's just that, you know, we've gotten to that place where, you know... If you give a gift for something, it's almost like you do it more spontaneously, right? So like, I knew my cousin or whatever wanted this one jersey of this one Met player, and I happened to find it the other day. It's not his birthday, it's not Christmas, but I got it for him. When Christmas rolls around, I'm not gonna get him something just for the sake of getting him something.
Mm-hmm.
But if there's something, I mean, I'll do it whenever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's more where I'm at. I'm not anti-gift giving. It worries me that, you know, shit gets way too big. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. I could see that spiraling out of control.
All right, I'm glad you see that.
Yeah.
All right, so that's all I got.
Yep, that's all I got.
All right, that sounds good. So that's it, guys. That's part deux. Why did I put that? I almost made it German. Part durch. It is part durch.
Parte dos.
Hey, parte dos. Is that part? Is parte?
I have
part.
No idea. That's the simplest word.
What do you mean?
I
have no idea. This is your. This is where you live. This is where you make your money. In the language. All right, guys. That's it. That's the second part of In Excelsis Deo. The next episode, I believe, is Lord John Marbury, where we get introduced to Lord John Marbury. What are you about to say?
Parte is
oh,
part,
very good. Yeah. Very good. Parte. Parte due.
No, that's Italian.
All right, geez. Forget it. I'm just sticking with English. That's it. Thank you, guys. The Architect signing out.
This is Anthony Caputo. Bye.